Hi there, it's Bill Radke, and you're listening to KUOW's The Record. Welcome to it. Lots to talk about today. Microsoft says it will renovate its Redmond digs.
Our goal is to build the most modern workplace and create the best employee experience, I think, in the world.
We'll learn more from GeekWire's Todd Bishop. Also, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau makes a historic apology.
We were wrong. We are sorry. We will never let this happen again.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer will tell you about that. And you will meet a Woodinville first responder who rescues hundreds every year.
Meow. Sophie.
Yeah, one of the guys from Animal Planet's Treetop Cat Rescue is here, so stay tuned for that. First things first, today on The Record, Seattle has a new mayor. Mayor number 4 this year. And yes, woman mayor number 2 of all time. She is Mayor Jenny Durkan. Welcome to work and welcome back to KUOW.
Hey, it's great to be here. How are you?
Good, thank you. Starting with that, how much does it matter that you are Seattle's first woman mayor in almost a century?
You know, I think it's really important. I think we need to show every young girl and every young boy they can be whatever they want to be. And it shouldn't take 92 years to have another woman mayor. But I'll show up to work every day working for everybody.
Have you had a minute to yourself to let all of it sink in? This job, your life?
I've not yet. I think different parts of it are hitting me at different times. Walking in the office today for the first time and seeing Office of the Mayor, Jenny A. Durkan, you know, it's real and the responsibility is enormous.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the responsibilities. Yesterday, you signed an executive order reaffirming the city's commitment to its race and social justice initiative. But the city's civil rights office told KUOW this week they're having trouble doing their job, partly because they don't have any enforcement authority. Would you give them that authority?
One of the things we're going to do is work with the Office of Civil Rights, and I've been talking to City Council already, to really do a vet and top-to-bottom review of the Office of Civil Rights to make sure that it's got the right powers and the right people in place, because that is such a critical component. As you know, I set up a civil rights division at the U.S. Attorney's Office, one of the first in the nation. It's an issue I care deeply about. It's an issue that matters to our city, so we're going to make sure it gets done right.
Also, Mayor Durkan, the city plans to make some neighborhoods denser and taller, and a group of neighborhood activists is challenging that plan. They say it will make Seattle far less affordable and bring more traffic, more pollution, and not enough schools. How do you respond?
We know that Seattle's going to grow, and we know that every part of the city is going to get density. But what we have to do is make sure we do it in a smart way and a way that gets developers to pay for low-income housing. That's why I've been so committed to the HALA process. But at the same time, I've made clear we want to have deep dialogue with each of the communities to make sure that we get this next phase of Seattle growth right. We're rebuilding this city for the future. Let's make sure we do it in the right way. So I look forward to having more engagement with people.
But what of those charges, if any, are true? Far less affordable if these changes go through. You know about the argument about teardowns and new, more expensive places going up. So this group of neighborhood activists says far less affordable with more traffic, more pollution, not enough schools. Is any of that fair?
No, if we do this right, I think what we'll do is we should improve all of those things for the people of Seattle. While we grow, we have to make sure that we have the right infrastructure in place so that we have better transit, better bus lines, easier for people to walk and bike. We also have to make sure that as we grow, that we are working with Seattle Public Schools to get enough schools in place to handle the growth as well. So I think all of this is going to require deep engagement across the city and regionally to make sure that we grow together in a way that makes sense.
Okay, so if I understand you right, it sounds like you're saying some of those concerns are fair, might be true, but you're promising to make sure that that's mitigated. Is that fair?
I think what's more fair is we've already seen those kind of impacts from the growth that we've had because we grew so quickly. Now we have to have smart growth, and we have to make sure as we grow as a city, we're thinking about holistically how we become a better city. That doesn't mean there's not going to be, you know, some amount of difficulty and pain in short terms. As we've said before, and you and I have talked about, for example, transportation will probably get worse in the next 3 to 4 years than better just because of all the mega projects coming online in downtown. So we have to have short-term fixes, but we have to do those fixes with a long-term view.
And another big challenge for you, this is Mayor Jenny Durkan, our brand new mayor of Seattle. How will the average Seattleite notice any difference in our homelessness crisis after 4 years of Mayor Durkan?
After 4 years, we hope to have more people off the street and in long-term housing. We will improve our short-term shelter. This will take, this problem has been years in the making and there is no immediate solution, but we'll have to have strategies in place for the different people and different populations that find themselves in those desperate conditions. You know, for example, the parents, particularly the women with children living in vehicles, they need a different strategy and solution than perhaps other people who have ended up experiencing homelessness. So we will have a range of strategies to deal with that. And at the end of 4 years, we hope that we have more people who are not just housed, but have the support they need for us to be proud of ourselves as a city.
Mayor Durkan, everybody's talking about sexual harassment, sexual misconduct, assault, Harvey Weinstein, Roy Moore, Kevin Spacey. Today, just today, it's Matt Lauer, Garrison Keillor, and I want to revisit our handling of the Ed Murray allegations. The first allegation against him was in April. You didn't call for him to resign until September. Has anything that's happened since in this national conversation made you think you made the wrong call on Ed Murray in any way?
We have to really look at this as a broad societal problem. And as you know, I've had experience representing, you know, victims of sexual assault and sexual harassment and have seen how difficult it is for them to come forward and think that we in every workplace and every part of our society have to have more supports for people to make those kinds of claims and feel supported. At the same time, I've also represented people who have been charged with things that they did not do, and it was proven later that they did not do. So building in due process is really important to where we are. You know, we are not in a, you know, going forward, I will make sure that the city of Seattle, that we review our own processes to make sure that our workplace is a place that is safe for people. They feel that there is a channel that they can raise concerns, and those concerns will be taken seriously.
So just to make sure I understand, some leaders called for Mayor Ed Murray's resignation earlier than you do. No regrets about your handling of that situation?
I think, again, I have to, you know, I'll say it again, I've said many times, I don't believe I was in any position to judge what happened over 3 decades ago. But what I do know is for the city of Seattle and for people, if people are in a workplace, they deserve to have a workplace that is free of that kind of discrimination and harassment, just as they're entitled to have a workplace that does not have racial discrimination or gender discrimination. And as chief executive of the city, I'm going to make sure that we redouble our efforts so that everyone shows up to work knowing that their work is valued and they will be treated fairly.
And my last word on that is that I ask because as the chief executive, you might end up having to judge some allegations that possibly happened 3 decades ago. That's part of what's difficult about these allegations.
You know, I think it is difficult. It's very rare, though, that you will have anyone in any kind of workplace today that is asked to judge an employee for things that may have happened 3 decades ago in a different state or a different place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what we will do going forward as a city, what I want to make clear to people is this is an issue that we know has been rampant in every kind of work situation. As a woman coming up in my profession, there was no job I ever had that I didn't feel this kind of discrimination. No job.
Really? No job you ever had?
No. And I think any woman that has worked in the workplace knows what it's like to be treated differently, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in big ways. And we're changing as a society, but as we change, what this conversation tells us is there is no free pass for people to be able to treat people without respect and dignity, and that everyone walking into a workplace or a restaurant or anywhere in society deserves to be treated with equal respect. And in the workplace, that means that you get equal pay. You don't have to be subject to harassment or racial discrimination or various kinds of aggressions, and that people know that they're going to be valued for what they can contribute.
Just two more questions for Seattle's new mayor, Jenny Durkan. Seattle's so far not on track to reach its goals regarding climate change, and you said during the campaign that's an important priority. What will you change?
It's one of the first briefings we're going to have is I've already sat down briefly with our folks and team on climate change to see what we can do to move the needle on that. we will redouble our efforts, and everyone should know we are absolutely committed to not just reaching our goals on climate change, but really being a national and world leader on climate issues. It did not get the attention in the campaign that some might think that it would have, just because we have such pressing issues. But it is a critical, critical issue for our city and for our planet, and we are committed to leading on that issue.
Finally, Mayor, you used to work for FIFA, the soccer governing body. The Sounders play in the Western Conference Championships tomorrow. What do you think of the two-legged final where away goals count more?
You know, I tell you, I'm so excited for the Sounders to be in the playoffs. And I'm glad that we've got Dempsey back. I hate to admit it, but when I moved about 10 years ago, I finally parted with my pair of shorts that were the original Sounders. And the only reason I could part with them is because we had the Sounders back. And I'm pretty confident that we've got the right people in place to do pretty well going forward.
A confident prediction. A confident mayor of Seattle. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We've told you about the trend. Companies aren't into suburbs anymore. They want to be in cities. Amazon, Weyerhaeuser, Expedia. So when Microsoft said it had a big announcement about its headquarters, I held my breath, Todd. Can I exhale now?
You may.
Okay. Todd Bishop with the Seattle tech news site GeekWire. Turns out they're doing a campus remodel.
HQ1, Bill.
HQ1. Doubling on the one.
Exactly. So this is the original, the OG,
yeah.
Redmond campus. It's a dozen buildings. They look like X-Wing fighters. That's sort of what they're known as. Mm-hmm. This is where Microsoft moved from Bellevue. You'll recall they originally moved from Albuquerque to the Seattle area, but they were over by the Burgermaster in Bellevue.
Yeah.
As fast food aficionados will tell you, this was the campus that they then moved to in Redmond. And Microsoft's huge advantage here in what they're doing is that they have 500 acres to work with. So they will be tearing down 12 of those original buildings and on that land creating something actually approximating an urban campus in the burbs.
What do you mean?
It's going to be dense. It's going to be built around open space. But
how can it be both dense and built around open space?
So the buildings themselves will be much closer together in a ring around open fields and soccer fields and cricket fields and also a public performance area and a place where the company's employees could gather for concerts or big events. But Microsoft's ace in the hole here, and this is not something you hear a lot in the Seattle region, is Sound Transit, because light rail in 5 to 7 years, you know, 2024,
yeah.
It will be extending from Seattle all the way up to Redmond, and Microsoft will be creating a pedestrian bridge over 520 that connects both the east and the west sides of the Microsoft campus to the light rail station. And so you start to see this vision of much more of an urban feel out there in the suburbs, and that's what they're going to be trying to create.
Okay, well, any giant project like that and getting rid of old buildings and what are we going to do now that we have another chance, that always interests me. But bigger picture, is it news? Like, why should I care about Satya Nadella's remodel?
Bottom line, this is going to create capacity for 8,000 new jobs out there. So that's the first statement about the economy and what Microsoft plans to do here.
And they wouldn't be making room for 8,000 more if they weren't going to hire 8,000 more?
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, at least they will have the capacity to do that. You know, they employ about 47,000 out there. It's interesting. The Microsoft and Amazon employee bases in the Seattle region are now actually pretty similar. You know, Amazon is right in that 40 to 50,000 range as well. Mm-hmm. And so you have Amazon, which is in the urban core of Seattle, being forced, they would tell you, to look elsewhere because they've essentially run out of room. Microsoft, on the other hand, has this campus where they can expand and do some really creative things with these original
buildings. You quoted Microsoft's president saying, we have the luxury of 500 acres, a luxury few companies have. But what about all the talk about Amazon heralds a new era? Companies all want to be in the urban core.
It's true. And obviously, Microsoft is at somewhat of a disadvantage because they are no longer really in Seattle proper. They had a presence in South Lake Union and Pioneer Square in Seattle for a few years. That is essentially gone at this point, with Amazon taking over every available piece of office space in South Lake Union. So Microsoft, in some ways, is at a hiring disadvantage, at least until the light rail comes into place, because the commute for people coming out of the Seattle core to Redmond and back over the bridge again, as everybody out there knows, can be very brutal.
Yes. But Microsoft is not pulling out of Bellevue, right? That would be disasters to overheat it. But that would be a big deal for Bellevue. But that's not happening.
Correct. We ask that specifically of Brad Smith, the Microsoft president, and he said they will be staying in Bellevue and other suburban Seattle facilities that they have. So that is still the plan.
Okay. You also quoted Microsoft's president saying the new campus gives us the ability to build a working environment that matches the culture that we're creating for Microsoft. What's that mean?
If you look at the original buildings,
The X-Wing Fighters.
First off, if you could find your way through those buildings, you deserve some kind of prize. I've gotten lost in those buildings more times than I can tell you.
Well, that was a sorting tool for them.
Exactly. The ultimate job interview test. Can you find the room?
Uh-huh.
They were built for an era of individual office spaces. For better or for worse, the tech industry and the culture of business are shifting to these open collaborative spaces now. And so that really is where Microsoft is headed. So this is a very divisive issue in the tech industry, by the way.
Why?
If you want to get into an argument with somebody, talk about open floor plan office spaces.
What's the argument?
People hate them. Companies are shifting toward them, but there is a segment of the tech population that absolutely hates this whole idea of nothing but open collaborative spaces because it's completely distracting to a lot of people. People sit there with their headphones on. At any rate,
are they just distracted or do they wish they were in their private office?
That's
goofing
right.
Off.
They do wish they were in their private office working hard, no doubt. At any rate, that is where Microsoft is headed with this, is toward the trend which you see at Facebook and Google and everywhere else, where it's an open floor plan. People can, you know, have the serendipity of hearing what's going on with a colleague's project and saying, hey, you know, .NET might be able to fix that. Or, you know, actually, let me, I'm dating myself there. Azure, I've got an Azure serverless function that will help you on that particular project.
That's how it happens on the current company video, you know, those serendipity moments.
Exactly. So that when they talk about embracing a new culture and the new way of work, it's that shift from individual offices to something more open.
Okay, and new buildings, so they're tearing some down and adding more than they're tearing down.
That's right.
No parking, right? Because the future's all Autobots.
So parking underground. So there will be parking.
Because I've done interviews with architects saying the future, you know, I'm already starting to design buildings that have a big drop-off area because it's all about, you know, cars coming and going and dropping off ride shares and self-driving.
Microsoft, at least, is not there yet.
Okay.
In fact, I think under one of their buildings on the West Campus, they have one of the largest parking garages in the Western Hemisphere. So
even with the light rail coming, doesn't change anything.
Apparently not. And of course, Microsoft would sit here and give you stat after stat about all of their carpooling, and Amazon would do the same thing in terms of employees walking to work. But the reality is a large percentage of the employee base is still going to get there via car.
Yeah. Okay. So finally then, Todd Bishop, no Microsoft HQ2 in Toronto. Is this what this is telling us? They're here?
That's
and
exactly
only here?
Right. And Satya Nadella, Microsoft CEO, has made this clear previously, but here is Microsoft walking the walk, not just talking the talk. But, Bill, there is one more important point.
Tell
that
me.
Really needs to be brought up.
What's that?
Lake Bill will remain.
This is my first question.
It is a pond in the original Microsoft campus where Steve Ballmer and other executives, by legend at least, would take dunks after key product milestones. Mike Maples, I think, is one of the old Microsoft executive who used to do this and started this tradition. They announced this at the shareholder meeting this morning. Of course, Lake Bill was named after Bill Gates.
Yes.
Bill Gates was sitting in the front row. I have never seen him grin more when he heard that Lake Bill would remain.
Phew! if that lake could talk.
His legacy is intact.
Okay. That's the news of Microsoft's, the big announcement was not HQ2. It's that they're betting more on Redmond, making room for 8,000 more workers with some teardowns and buildups. And that is Todd Bishop with GeekWire. Always great to talk to you, Todd. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
The Record on KUOW resumes in a moment. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Look! Up in the air! It's a bird! It's a plane! Oh, no, that's a cat stuck up in a tree.
It's a cat, it's yeah. A
cat.
In the Pacific Northwest, we have a big problem high up in our giant trees.
Every year, hundreds of cats are looking for someone to save them.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Tom.
We're two guys that love cats.
Hi, Dar Dar.
We practically speak cat.
Meow. Sophie.
This isn't just a job, this is something we need to do.
Okay.
Oh, geez, don't fall, please.
That is Sean Sears and Tom Otto on their Animal Planet show, Treetop Cat Rescue. Their Woodinville company, Canopy Cat Rescue, is on target to rescue almost 6,500 cats this year. Tom is probably 100 feet up in a Doug fir right now. I don't know, but Sean is with me in the studio. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Great
Thanks
to meet you. Thanks for coming in and telling the story. Why? First of all, there's so many things I want to know. I've got one cat myself. Why does a cat climb a tree and just keep going up and up?
Yeah, well, I mean, we could talk about this topic all day long.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, how much time do we have?
we'll see.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of falsehoods about cats and trees out there, and Tom and I have sort of found ourselves on this stage sort of screaming at the top of our lungs that most of what people think or know about cats and trees is false. And so, you know, we're on pace to do, you know, 470 rescues this year. Since we started our company in 2009, we're, you know, well over 2,000 rescues, you know, cats from trees. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of people don't realize is that when a cat climbs a tree, they're having to make a split second choice. Am I going to get eaten or climb this tree?
They're running from something.
They're running from something. They're not just climbing this tree. Hey, what's up there? And, you know, in our area, lots of coyotes, lots of loose dogs, lots of cats, lots of raccoons. We see one of two things most often. We see a family with a house that lives right on the edge of a green space, a park, a forest, where there's lots of coyotes and wildlife that comes into the neighborhoods and preys on small animals. We see that, and we see a heavily segmented neighborhood with tall fences and dogs on each corner of the fences.
So if your cat keeps getting stuck in a tree, it might be having some trauma that you didn't know about.
Right, and it's probably time to have some sort of behavioral change. And so that's another thing that we do is we educate people, okay, if your cat's running into issues outside, it's probably time to keep them indoors. We've had countless people, you know, say, you know, message us on our Facebook page. Hey, do you remember Fluffy that you rescued 6 months ago?
Of course, you remember every single one.
Every single one. Well, Fluffy never came home one day, and our neighbor found a pile of white fur in her backyard.
Oh.
So it's one of those things. It's not a lesson that the cat learns. It's a lesson that the owner learns. If you value your cat, you know, love this little precious furry ball, you know, make some behavioral changes. If it's getting caught in a tree, you know, maybe once, maybe give it another shot. But if they're running into issues outside, it's time to keep them indoors. Indoors is definitely the safest spot for cats. However, 25-30% of our calls are indoor-only cats that escape outside, and then they're just like a fish out of water.
But they don't just run for trees. Even they're running from something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yep.
The other half of my question was, once they're in a tree, why do they keep climbing?
Right, and that's a super popular question.
You're safe, Fluffy. You did it.
Yeah, you did it. And a lot of times they climb up to
Take your winnings. Exactly. Quit while you're ahead.
Exactly. Cats' claws are shaped like fish hooks. And so it's really easy for them to climb up. It's very difficult, though not impossible, for them to climb down. Oh. And so those fish hooks, you know, boom, they climb right up these tall evergreens that we have here in Washington State. It's the evergreen state. We have lots of those trees.
Yes.
These trees act as natural escape routes for stressed out cats. And so it's
why, really, especially evergreen trees? That they're really big?
Really, you know, probably especially evergreen trees. It's tougher for them to climb slick bark trees like a madrone or alder, even though they sometimes do climb those. But, you know, you look at the bark difference between those types of trees and like a fir, hemlock, cedar, it's really easy for them to get a purchase on those trees.
Yeah, I can see that.
But why they climb up and don't climb down is, you know, it's really easy for them to climb up. They get up, they're in a safe spot. They're like, okay, I just escaped death. I'm probably not going to climb down. Sometimes they do. Sometimes folks call us and the cat's literally been stuck for like 5 minutes. And we're like, you know, you might want to give them a little bit of time. Sometimes they can figure it out. But it's not one of those things where they're just going to casually saunter down the tree when they get hungry. Tom and I have both rescued cats that have been stuck up in trees for 15, 16 days.
Do you think that they're staying in the tree because they, as you just said, they got chased up by a predator and that's still in the, I don't know how smart cats are.
They're like, very smart.
Really?
Very smart.
So they're staying up there because they know what's at the bottom.
Right. And those two big circumstances that I mentioned earlier, you know, a family on the edge of a green space, you know, big park or whatever where there's coyotes or things like that, and then this heavily segmented neighborhood with tall fences and dogs. If there's dogs roaming around in the base of the tree and just waiting, you think the cat's going to climb down? No, no.
I never thought of that. Don't just call you. Yeah. Clear the base of the tree.
Exactly. Yeah. And we've come across situations where, you know, it's in a very rural area and we're tromping through the brush and in the back of this forest, and then the folks are like, "Yeah, see, there's my cat in the tree," and then out pops a coyote from the base of the tree.
Yeah.
You know, they'll mark the base of the tree with feces and urine and things like that to sort of persuade the cat from not climbing down. But, you know, we always say anything is
possible. Wait a minute, they don't want the cat to climb down?
Right.
Why not? I would think they want their dinner to come back.
Well, that's partially true, but, you know, they're sort of just marking their territory.
Yeah.
We've even heard stories of bobcats going up after cats in trees. You know, the big piles of raccoon feces or coyote feces or dog feces at the base of the tree, like, haha, I just did this. You know, I'm going to wait for this guy to come down. When and if he does, you know, it's a free meal for me.
So bobcats don't recognize their own and stay away from little cats.
No,
not at all.
No, they will. They will totally go after him.
I have so many more questions, cat rescue questions, for Sean Sears. He and Tom Otto are on this Animal Planet show, Treetop Cat Rescue, and they're local. Mm-hmm. Their company is Canopy Cat Rescue, and they're based in Woodinville, and they operate all around Western Washington, right?
Yep. I live in Woodinville. My partner, rescue partner Tom, lives in Olympia.
Olympia, yeah.
And
so
they
cover a lot of ground.
That enables us to service a huge area. Like after this interview, I'm heading up to Whidbey Island for a cat in a tree.
Wait a minute. There's a cat in the tree and it's waiting for
it's
you
waiting
to
for
get
me.
This interview done?
Yep.
Great. That's a high guilt factor for every question, every follow-up I ask you.
Yeah.
Fluffy is still up there.
Yep, Fluffy's still, he's waiting.
Do you feel okay about continuing this conversation?
I do. I do. I feel
all right.
Okay.
I'm trusting you.
Yep.
I got, a lot of cat rescue questions. I just very briefly, what made you, how did you come to found this company? What made you think this is going to be a going, happening concern?
Well, you know, both Tom and I really love cats. You know, we've loved and owned cats the better part of our entire lives. And so, you know, back in the late 2000s, we had our own tree service. We did very specialized stuff for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And in any established tree sort of business, you're going to get called for things in trees, whether it's cats, drones, helicopters, balloons, you name it. And so
you could have been a drone rescue company.
Totally
you could branch out into that. Who
exactly,
knows? But you went for cat.
But there's the sympathy isn't there for drones unless it's a very, very expensive drone.
No drones are named Fluffy.
Exactly.
Yep.
And so, you know, established tree sort of business, you get called for things in trees. And so we'd start out with just like maybe 1-2 calls a month. And so back then we had our own fee, you know, whether it was $75 or $150. And so we started to, you know, get more and more calls. And then we started to witness this sort of little phenomena where, you know, we would tell folks a price and then they'd be like, "Wow, all right, let me call you back." And then Tom and I were just like, wait a minute, there's a reason they're not calling us back. And so a lot of people can't afford your standard fee to have an arborist climb up a tree to rescue a cat. So Tom and I clued in on that a long time ago, and that was sort of our aha moment. We were like, you know what? Let's do this on a donation basis. If folks want to donate to us, great. Otherwise, if they can't afford it, we're going to help them for free.
How much do they typically end up donating to you?
You know, I mean, we've gotten cherry and apple pies. We've gotten, like, you know, Starbucks gift certificates. We've gotten everything under the sun for donations. But, I mean, typically, you know, it's $50, $75, $100. People will donate to us. But, you know, some folks that are on a fixed income, you know, they'll they'll give us $5-$10.
What were you charging them before? What were you trying to charge?
It really depended on how far we drove. Yeah. $75 to $100.
Okay.
Depending on how far we had to drive. But obviously that changed quickly. Because Tom and I have really big hearts for cats, but we also have really big hearts for people as well. And so, you know, we sort of think about this as saving the cat, but really we're saving the family as well. You know, they're in this incredibly stressed out situation where they're calling everybody that they think would help in this situation. Folks call us and they're like, I've tried everybody. I've called the police. I've called animal control. I've called my vet.
What about fire department?
And every single person that they call just like, ha ha, we don't do that.
Fire department will tell you no?
No, they will not.
I didn't know that. That's like a Norman Rockwell picture I have.
And that's one of those things that we try to educate folks on is that, no, the fire department will not help you. Now, there are the rare circumstances where the fire department will. Now, if you call the fire department and they're, you know, ask them if they do cat and tree rescues, they're not going to do it. You know, but recently there was a Seattle rescue that I couldn't get for a couple of hours, and the fire department was driving by, and the cat was only up like 20 feet. And this lady flagged down the fire department. She was like, can you guys help us? And they were like, eh, all right. But
could you tell the fire department there's a fire in your tree?
Right.
And then if they investigate, you say, oh, I guess right. I was wrong. I guess that was my cat.
No.
While you're up there.
No. So generally, no, they don't help with cats and trees. But the interesting thing is that people have gotten so desperate in this situation where they're like, okay, my cat's up in the tree. Nobody's helping me. I'm going to climb it. And then they get up there and get in a very unsafe situation. And then the fire department will come out and save you, but leave your cat in the tree.
No, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, fire department drawing bright lines.
Right. Yeah, okay. And, you know, like, you know, obviously, you know, we're not here to talk bad about firefighters. I had like two of my best friends are firefighters. We have family in the fire service, so we're very aware of what their job entails.
But they're highly species conscious.
That's right. Just the fact. You know, the thing is that they don't want to have their big boom truck up into a tree rescuing a cat and then get a house fire call with six kids in the basement.
Yes, fair enough.
And so that's where they sort of draw the line. And, you know, a lot of times they'll give out really great information. Like a lot of local fire departments will say, okay, there's these guys locally that are pretty well known for getting cats out of trees. Call them. Some of them will give out bad information like, oh, just leave food at the base of the tree. That thing will climb down when he gets hungry. You've never seen a cat skeleton in a tree. And then they'll hang up.
Food at the bottom of the tree. Yeah. What? Well, you just said that it's probably was chased up there.
Right.
Is the raccoon going to eat that food
exactly.
at the bottom of the tree?
And so that's one of the big things that Tom and
What if I'm standing vigil, though? I'm there, and I have food, Kitty's favorite food, at the bottom of the tree. Is that okay?
It's probably not going to make a big difference. Yeah,
far away.
Yeah, and I mean, like I told you earlier, we've rescued cats that have been stuck for 15, 16 days.
Yeah.
You think those guys are hungry?
Right.
They're real hungry. I have a cat at home. He gets hungry after 3 hours.
Yeah, that's true.
And so generally, food at the base of the tree is only going to attract more predators to the base of the tree. And the cat's going to see that, and they're going to be like, oh, geez, why do they put food down there?
Right.
It's not helping anything.
That's right. That's why I'm 100 feet up.
And so then they're like, ugh. They're just seeing these animals at the base of the tree just gnaw on some food. They're just like, that wasn't a very good idea.
And humans are stupid.
Right.
We're talking about cat rescue with an expert. Sean Sears and Tom Otto have the Animal Planet Show Treetop Cat Rescue, and their company, Canopy Cat Rescue, is in Woodinville and Olympia. And so walk me through it. Somebody calls you to say that Cassidy, my personal cat, Cassidy's in a tree. What happens next? You show up and what?
Right. So, you know, it really all depends on, you know, we get this question a lot is how soon do we come on out? And it really depends on a lot of things. When we get the call, how long the cats have been stuck, the temperament of the cat, the location of the cat. All these sort of things we factor in as to when we come on out. Now, if it's a super friendly cat that's been stuck, you know, more than a few hours, 12 hours, maybe overnight, then we're coming out immediately. If it's a really skittish cat that doesn't like people, you know, we might give them a little bit more time because what we're worried about there is the cat jumping. Where is the cat? Is this tree in your yard? Is it in a neighbor's yard? Where is it? If it's in the neighbor's yard, it's likely that we're going to need to contact the owner of that property just to get permission to access the property. That's a huge thing. We don't want people to come home and be like, what's this guy doing up in my tree? But likely when we get the call, we respond the same day. You know, other things factor in, weather, how long is the drive, things like that. You know, if we're dealing with like a windstorm or thunder and lightning, you know, we're probably not going to be able to come out and climb a tree in those types of situations.
Okay, so once you get up to Cassidy,
yep,
then what do you do?
So climbing the tree is another 3-hour conversation there, but generally...
Really? 3 hours?
Well,
you're an arborist. You're,
yeah. Okay, maybe 5 minutes.
Okay.
But generally how we climb the tree is we use a big slingshot or a weighted throw line.
Okay.
A lot of people assume that we're going to show up with the big spikes on the feet and just sort of saunter up the tree. And we'll use those if we absolutely have to. But generally, we climb the tree using non-invasive techniques where they're not going to hurt the tree. And so we'll shoot a line up in the tree with a big slingshot and then pull a rope up. And that's like our He-Man tool. You know, kids see that and they're just like, wow, I want one of those.
Does that sometimes just scare the cat down?
Sometimes it does.
Okay.
Yeah, anything's possible. Sometimes it scares them higher. Sometimes they go out
true.
On a limb.
Okay.
Sometimes
so
they'll hear the rustling of the branches above them. They'll be like, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
So we'll climb up, you know, pull a rope up, climb up the rope, and we'll get close to the cat.
Yep.
And, you know, that's sort of the critical moment there. And obviously it goes back to the temperament questions that we ask the folks, you know, is this cat a friendly cat? Does it like people? Is it afraid of men? What does it do like when strangers come over to the house? Does it run and hide? Does it come out and say hello? Those are going to be the huge questions that we ask, and that's going to sort of prepare us as to that first contact that we make with the cat.
Really? I didn't know it was that involved. You've got all this information, and so how would you just profiled Cassidy, and how do you use that information next?
Right. So the huge thing that's going to specify those differences is most of the time when we get up to the cat, we make friends with the cat, we let him smell us, we, you know, give him some chin scratches, and then, you know, we pick him up as you normally would a cat, and then we gently put him in a sack. And so if people ever watch our videos, they're going to be like, well, it wasn't very gentle that they put him in the sack. And sometimes it's not. I mean, sometimes it's a very split second decision where, okay, you need to go in the sack really quick because we need to get out of here.
You were in a tree. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, generally we put him in a sack and then we climb down and we have the owners put bring the kitty in the sack indoors, let him out of the sack.
But do you bring food in your hand?
Sometimes we bring treats, but generally they're not really excited about eating up in the tree.
Oh, okay.
They're just like, okay, get me out of here.
Right. Let's not overcomplicate this.
Right. Yeah. And so the huge distinction between, you know, a really friendly cat and a skittish cat is, all right, are we going to need this big, long net that we have? We have this net. It's like the size of a salmon net that we can put on long poles that will enable us to reach well over 25 feet beyond us. And so if a cat climbs to the very, very top of a tree or way out on a branch, we'll use this net to sort of scoop them up or maybe kind of usher them back to us to where we can successfully get them in a sack.
I'm scared hearing that because I'm picturing you like trying to grab it with a net or put a net over it, but it's on, you just said it was on a skinny little branch.
Yep.
How often do you get a cat fall?
Yeah, I would say probably 1 in 20 cats will jump or slip or fall out of the tree.
1 in 20? That's a lot when you're doing 5,000 a year.
Yep. Well,
or not 500 a year.
Yeah. It might get there.
Yeah.
It might.
Who knows?
Obviously, there's, again, with that risk, where there's other things to consider. Okay, what's at the base of the tree? Is there rocks? Is there concrete? Is it grass? Is it like 6 inches of cushiony beauty bark? And those things also factor in to how we prepare for the rescue. Now, if it's a skittish cat and we think it's going to jump and there's jagged rocks at the base of the tree, we're going to have like a team of people, neighbors and friends and family members of the cat hold sheets at the base of the tree to cushion his jump or fall out of the tree.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
So
friends and family members of the cat.
Yep.
And I kind of don't want the answer, but I feel like I kind of have to ask, how often do you lose a cat?
You know, unfortunately, you know, we've rescued thousands of cats from trees and, you know.
Because mostly they land on their feet,
well,
as we all know, or do they?
Generally speaking.
Oh.
But then there's this ricochet effect where they jump out of the tree and then they come in contact with branches. And if you've ever seen the Price is Right game show, you know, there's this game called the Plinko, where they hit a little peg.
Oh, yeah, and hang off it back. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what happens. And so cats don't always land on their feet. But yeah, I mean, you know, Tom and I unfortunately have lost two cats that have jumped and not made it. And
that's
so,
not bad.
Right. And so, you know, we sort of look at those as learning opportunities. And, you know, unfortunately, it's a risk.
You know what? We just have a couple minutes left. And I really don't want to end on that image.
Yeah.
So I want to ask, how can owners keep cats from climbing trees and getting stuck in the first place?
So number one is keep them indoors.
Yes.
If they don't,
that's what I do.
If they absolutely do not want to be indoors, there's these things called catios, which are these outdoor cat enclosures that people can, you know, people can make them as extravagant or as simple as they want. Basically, they're like sort of a glorified chicken coop. You know, they make this outdoor enclosure where the cat can be outside and safe and not be chased up a tree. There's other things as well, like putting your cat on a leash or, you know, getting them used to sort of walking on a leash. I sort of say, all right, if your cat is prone to running into issues outside, think of them like a dog and not a cat. All right. If they want to be outside, take them on outside, hang out with them. And then as soon as they're done doing whatever they need to do, pick them up and bring them back inside.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where if they're running into issues like climbing trees, you got to think about it, keeping them and the trees separate. Because if they are running into issues outside, it's going to be a continued problem. We've rescued one cat as many as 6 times from trees.
Yeah, we don't want that. Okay, we got to go. You ever rescue anything that's not a cat?
Wild birds, you know, get stuck on like kite string or fishing string. We've rescued those. Iguanas, parrots, pet birds.
Sean Sears, his company is Canopy Iguana Rescue. No, that's not true. Canopy Cat Rescue, which got famous with that Animal Planet program.
Yeah.
Woodinville and Olympia, and you're headed to Whidbey Island?
Whidbey Island.
Go. I cannot keep this cat waiting a second longer.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for telling us all about it.
All right.
Good luck to you and that cat today.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. KUOW's The Record is coming right back. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In a long, emotional address yesterday, Canada's Prime Minister apologized for decades of discrimination that LGBTQ2 Canadians faced from their own federal government. Trudeau described the so-called gay purge that saw thousands of people investigated, humiliated, and kicked out of the military and public service.
Bathhouses were raided. People were entrapped by police. Our laws bolstered and emboldened those who wanted to attack non-conforming sexual desire. Our laws made private and consensual sex between same-sex partners a criminal offense.
After that speech, one of Canada's opposition leaders said Trudeau's apology will ring hollow unless he goes further. Here with the story is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill. Very emotional day in Canada's Parliament yesterday. The Prime Minister was wiping tears away from his eyes at one point. Two of his own children watching from the public galleries as he delivered, a heartfelt apology. One that was long overdue and one that doesn't begin to address all the concerns raised by that community.
Will you tell us more about Canada's discrimination and this gay purge?
It goes back to the Cold War, actually the World War II era, the 1940s. They started identifying homosexuals as security risks, as risks of blackmail, and started purging them, and it went on for a long time. There was persecution as well in other ways, but that was the big one. And the government has established a compensation fund to address all of that wrongdoing. They don't know how many people are still around who were victims, but they're expecting there may be several thousand claimants. The fund is over $100 million Canadian, so there could be sizable payouts. I believe the Canadian government calculates that this would be the largest such compensation fund ever offered anywhere in the world.
You mentioned blackmail risk. You're saying that because of the stigma around homosexuality, some Canadians might be blackmailed by enemies?
Yeah, that was one of the concerns. I mean, the other concern was that it was regarded as deviant behavior. I mean, there's no disguising the contempt with which those communities were held in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And even recently, Trudeau's father, when he was prime minister in 1968, decriminalized homosexuality. But as advocates for the community have pointed out, that didn't end the discrimination and the problems. And in fact, Some of those problems continue to this day. One example, there's still prejudice against gay men donating blood, the feeling that because of HIV and all of that, that they're a high risk. The community has said, this is one of the reasons some people say what Trudeau did yesterday is hollow. The government's got to change that as well. They promised to do it. They haven't done it yet. And there are other issues for that community, including some antiquated passages of the Canadian Criminal Code that have still not been repealed and that deal with what is still classified as gross indecency.
By the way, in the United States, men who have sex with other men cannot give blood for 12 months after their last sexual encounter. The UK just reduced that waiting period to 3 months. And yes, this opposition leader said it was just unsupported by the science.
Yeah, and the Canadian health authorities say there is no reason to maintain that. I mean, that is rooted in the big scare around HIV and AIDS, really going back to the 1980s. But the reasons for it are long gone. And as I said, when the Liberals ran for office, they promised to get rid of it. They've not done it yet. What the Prime Minister did yesterday is certainly a start, and everyone's welcomed it, but there's still more work to be done.
You called the apology overdue, Vaughn. Why have previous Prime Ministers not apologized? Has that been a debate in Canada?
You know, I think there's been a feeling that we've dealt with it. We've dealt with it. You know, originally there was decriminalization in 1968, and Trudeau's father said the state has no place in the bedrooms of the nation. And that sort of ended it, that issue. Well, then we had legalization of same-sex marriage with a lot of encouragement from the Canadian courts. So that seemed to have dealt with it. We've had sexual orientation in the human rights codes in the country for a long time. The courts have ruled and voided some sections of the criminal code that were used against gays. So we've had incremental change all along. I think this is the first time you've had a prime minister put it all together and say, in addition to all that, and in addition to what we still need to do, this apology is central to the recognition, and he has now done it. We've had apologies to other groups in Canada, the Japanese Canadians for persecution, Chinese Canadians for immigration barriers, so it's not unheard of for our governments to do this. But in that sense, this one is long overdue.
Are there any other debates now? Anything else the Canadian government is considering apologizing for?
I would think our record is not entirely clean on everything. We've also apologized for Aboriginal Canadians, Indigenous Canadians, for taking their children away from them and putting them into residential schools where they were abused. So we have made some progress in that, but I wouldn't say that all of the redress for past wrongs has yet been accomplished.
That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer telling you about the Prime Minister's speech yesterday. The government, as Vaughn mentioned, coming up with a compensation fund for LGBTQ2 people. By the way, some of our listeners might not be familiar with LGBTQ2. The two means two-spirited. I associate that term with Canada's First Nations people.
That is correct.
Yeah. And by the way, this new Liberal legislation will expunge those convictions for consensual sex acts that Prime Minister Trudeau described. Vaughn Palmer, thanks for joining us, as always.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And thank you for listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Coming up, NBC fires Matt Lauer, APM fires Garrison Keillor. Congressional leaders say they want to stop sexual harassment on Capitol Hill, but how? You'll hear a report on that later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. That's it for The Record. Our show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. Come back tomorrow when my guests are actors Jane Lynch and Kate Flannery from The Office. Looking forward to that. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you tomorrow.